December 19th, 2013, and this is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we have as our distinguished guest the noted author on subjects arcane and esoteric, John Michael Greer. Now, John's first book, Paths of Wisdom, has been of considerable help to us as an authoritative source in our ongoing series of lectures on the Hermetic Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Now, John is also the translator of the medieval Latin version of Picatrix with Christopher Warnock, which has now become as important in the magical revival as Tyson's Agrippa. And although certainly a Hermetic scholar, John Michael Greer's magical heart lies in the Celtic Druidic tradition. And he's written several books in this area, and he's a practicing Druid himself. His latest work combines the Hermetic Golden Dawn and the Druidic traditions, both of which were active in Victorian England. John discovered a historic interchange between these two very British expressions, and he has lovingly reconstructed the synthesis in his book, The Celtic Golden Dawn. So, let's go out to Stonehenge and see how the Druids do a pentagram ritual. Now, this is a very, very close to my heart kind of a program tonight because, as you know, Farfaria is also one of my magical traditions. Fred Adams was my magical master, and Fred was a Robert Graves type druid, and of course, Farfaria is like Robert Graves, a mixture of the what you might call the Druidic tradition and the and ancient Greek mythology, especially the Eleusinian mysteries, and so I just love Farfaria, and so the idea of the Druidic tradition, which was the most powerful and the most esoteric tradition in pagan Europe, north of the Roman Empire. And the Druids were awesome in their magic and in their religious theological beliefs. The Romans were terrified of them, and they of course inspired the Celtic, British and Irish, and the ancestors of the Welsh, and the Gaels in France. They inspired these Celtic warriors to present a formidable resistance to Roman conquest, and the Romans had contempt for most of the other pagan religions, but the Druids they were really frightened. The Druidism had a power and a magic that frightened them, and so that tradition is still alive and well. John, are you on the line?
I am indeed. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah! Did you hear my introduction to this?
I did indeed.
Well, from that point, hand it over to you and tell us about the revival of the Druidic tradition and what you've done with it.
How I found Goddess and what I did to her when I found her.
Not what you did to it, what you did with it.
That was a good point. Well, basically, one of the things that we have to stress in the modern Druid movement is that if we have any contact or any connection with the traditions of the ancient Druids, it's on a magical plane. The Romans were very thorough. The Christians were even more thorough. And the last organized bodies of Druids that we know of went extinct around the 9th century when they tried and failed to keep the Picts from converting to Christianity. Were there scraps that remained? Yes. There was a whole range of legend and lore, stuff that was preserved in Wales in the form in you know, various changed forms in terms of the Mabinogion, stuff that was saved in Wales and Brittany in the form of the Arthurian legends, a great deal of Irish and Scottish material, lots of folklore. Also, scraps of information that was preserved in Greek and Roman authors. And these were the things that, right around the end of the 17th century, started inspiring people in Britain, mostly at the beginning, to turn their attention to the ancient Druids. It was a good time for that because people were getting over the very savage religious quarrels of the Thirty Years' War and the English Civil War and all this kind of stuff when Episcopalians and Presbyterians were knifing each other in the streets over their religious differences.
Yeah.
And it was a messy time. A lot of people were looking at that and saying, you know, a religion that does this has some problems. Maybe we should look at some alternatives. And also, of course, this was right around the beginning, the first stirrings of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of people were looking at the eager destruction of the environment that was already going on in Britain at that time. Coal mining, the coal burning, the first factory smokestacks coming into being, and looking at that and going, "Ick! This is something is very wrong here. Something is profoundly wrong here." And so, a lot of these people in the very late 17th and through the middle of the 18th centuries were just going, "There's got to be another option." Something other than either the dogmatic Christianity on the one hand that was so common those days and the dogmatic scientific materialism that was just getting going. And some of them found the answer they were looking for in the scraps of lore that survived from the ancient Druids. And so we get the Druid revival out of that. We get the emergence of the first known for documented Druid traditions in Britain. Maybe the claim within the tradition is that the first meeting of the first Druid organization in Britain happened in a London pub in 1717. Now, I tend to agree
with that. That sounds like about the same. Wait. That sounds about like the same way Masonry got started.
That's right.
Yeah,
in a London pub
in 1717.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, the thing
that's
is,
for the same reason too. But let me while you were talking about all of the Civil War and all of this religious bigotry and strife and everything,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the reasons why Masonry was established,
mm-hmm.
was sort of, so all these people could sit down together and do business without having to worry about
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that this Druidic revival comes up the same time, at the same time as Masonry.
And it may have been inspired by that, because it did happen the same year, and if that's when it happened. Again, this is a tradition. There are people looking for documentation, haven't found it yet that I know of. But it was certainly around the same time, and the example of the Masons having gotten together and founded, of course, the first of the Grand Lodges, was on a lot of people's minds. And so that may have been what got a bunch of Druids to look at each other and say, you know, well, we could do this. And besides, it's a pub. We can order beer. This is actually surprisingly important. Most of the major events in British Druid history have taken place in a pub.
That doesn't surprise me at all. Because, but let me ask you, though, back up a little bit. I remember reading about the Romans burning up that library off the coast of Wales, and the last of the Druid scholars fought the last man, and then the Romans burned the library, almost like burning the library at Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you said that there was another burning later on in the Christian in the ninth century.
Not so much a matter of burning, but remember the Romans never succeeded in conquering Scotland or Ireland, so both of those areas kept on having Druids until quite some time later.
Yeah. Right.
And so,
and
but
they memorized, and they did memorize everything, right?
Oh yeah,
but
yeah.
Their
everything
rituals,
had to,
yeah.
Everything, well, everything according to the record, the classical records that we have, nothing religious, nothing spiritual or magical at all got written down. They were literate; they knew how to use Greek letters to write their own language, but you didn't write down the secrets of the Druids, and
yeah.
So what happened was, in Ireland, they got elbowed out by the Christians in the century or so after St. Patrick's time, say 5th and 6th centuries A.D. And then Christian missionaries descended on what's now Scotland, and was then Pictland. And the Picts gradually, you know, there was all the usual kerfuffle. But it was in about the 9th century that the last Pictish kingdoms converted to Christianity. And at that point, the Druids were out of luck. And, you know, there were, of course, the Christians' usual unfortunate predilection for killing people who disagreed with them was always an option or was an issue in those days. And so, yeah, so as far as we know, the 9th century is when the last of them were running around. There were bardic traditions, which probably include a lot of Druid lore that survived in Scotland, in Wales, and in Ireland until quite a bit later. And there's a lot of speculation as to what might have leaked on through, because there were people in the early days of the Druid tradition who had connection with certainly Irish and Bart and Welsh Bardic traditions. But, you know, again, the documentation is very hard to come by. And of course, you know, as with everything these days, a lot of embarrassing claims have been made by people who say, oh, sure, this descends from the Stone Age, when they made it up last night over pizza.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You said, I cut my magical teeth on Farfaria out here with Fred Adams.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And in fact, I consider Fred my master. And mm-hmm. Fred was the White Goddess was probably one of the major works
mm-hmm.
that inspired Fred. And
mm-hmm.
he, Eleusinian Mysteries is what he wanted to recreate, the Cori
mm-hmm.
especially. And
mm-hmm.
yet, Graves, as you know, Graves saw a combination, he saw a connection between Greek mythology and the Druids. And he came up with that tree alphabet quite a bit of that. Now, are you still using that tree alphabet that Graves came up with?
Well, actually, yes, but not because I think it's historically accurate. Okay, I have no idea there's no trace of the tree. Well, the alphabet, of course, is very ancient. The OM alphabet is very ancient. The calendar and the symbolism he put into it. I would point out that one of the things we know about all the ancient Celtic peoples is that the utterances of an inspired poet had the force of scripture. And Graves was an inspired poet. We have his description of how the White Goddess got written. He was working on a completely different project. And all of a sudden, this stuff started forcing its way into his mind. And he wrote, like, what, a 40,000-word book in 3 weeks? Having written books that long, longer still, I can tell you that's an immense amount of work in a very short time.
Whoa.
So, you know, he was inspired. Here we have the utterances of an inspired poet. Why not use them? It's a good symbolism. It works. We don't have to worry about the historical thing. We just say, okay, well, you know, this was created by Robert Graves. He was inspired by a goddess. Okay, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think that personally, I think Robert Graves is, you know, has achieved the status of a venerable. Well, he's dead now, naturally,
mm-hmm.
and that helps. I think he's an esoteric authority as far as I'm concerned. But then I was
burn incense to the man. I have no problem with this.
But I think that the legends of the Druids and I remember I went when I was 16 years old. I went through my Celtic phase, read the whole Mabinogion, or at least
mm-hmm.
as much
mm-hmm.
as I could get a hold of, and
mm-hmm.
I even memorized a Welsh triad, which
mm-hmm.
believe it or not, I can still recite it.
There you go.
It stuck in my mind. But the triads, Taliesin, that legendary poet. How much of his the Druid lore do you think has survived in the triads and in Taliesin's work?
It's that, of course, the academics debate about that one. I tend to think there's a fair amount. I would say also that whatever the sources of the magical lore in the triads, whatever the sources of Taliesin's visions and the stuff of the Mabinogi and all this kind of stuff, it makes great raw material for magical and spiritual practice. And there again, you know, what the historical thing is not the most important dimension. The important dimension is, does it work? I sometimes get rather amused by the kind of people who insist that their magical traditions have to date back to the old Stone Age or what have you. But would they think of using a 2-year-old computer? Not a chance.
No, you're right. And my feeling is if it's elegant and if it's romantic,
mm-hmm.
and especially if it's elegant, it needs to be
mm-hmm.
elegant. I get it. And Graves is so elegant. I mean, yeah. Now the Druids, they were, one of the things I know we know about them is they were
mm-hmm.
they were adamant believers in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
all the Celts were, to the point that you could take out a loan with a Celtic guy and promise to pay him back in your next incarnation, and he'd take the IOU.
I was telling Lauren tonight about that at dinner while we were talking about it. I said, yeah, you could pay off your debt if you in your next incarnation. Yeah, they were adamant believers in this, and yet I won't mention his name, but we had a fellow that you would immediately recognize if I told you who he was. And one time we were on a TV show, and he
mm-hmm.
was the Druid. He was supposedly
mm-hmm.
the Reformed Druid, you know. And Tom Snyder asked me, well, what do you folks believe in, you know, in an afterlife? Fitch was sitting there, and myself and Fred Adams and I said, well, I think most of us believe in reincarnation, and here
mm-hmm.
here the druid turns around and says, I don't. The one thing we really are sure of that he didn't believe. So your druidic tradition definitely believes and holds some false forth on that, right?
Well, we certainly teach it. One of the things about the order that I had, the Ancient Order of Druids in America, is that we don't put a lot of stress on belief. Okay, everybody has opinions, right? And there are things that we teach that we expect people to study and meditate on, but we're not going to tell them what opinions to hold. First of all, that doesn't work. Second of all, one of the basic principles of the Druid Revival since 1717 is that if you ask a question to 3 Druids, you'll get at least 5 different answers. Diversity, we have it. And so certainly, you know, we teach that. That's part of the traditional lore. It's something that deserves study and attention. And there's a specific theory, a specific traditional theory of the way that that rebirth, that reincarnation works in the process of spiritual advancement from life to life, that you get in the writings of Iolo Morganwg, who's another hot potato we can discuss. But I personally believe in it. But, you know, different druids have different opinions, and we don't really worry about, you know, who believes what. It's do you get along well with others, and do you actually do the studies and the practices?
Yeah. So now, your magic, though, I would assume, being based upon what I've experienced with Fred Adams and all, I would assume that you're and also looking over your output and various books
mm-hmm.
you've written, that you're very much concerned with nature and with ecology and with the seasons
mm-hmm.
and with herbs and
mm-hmm.
forestry and all of that. I would assume that would have a large part of
yeah.
what you're doing, right?
Oh yeah. Well, that's part of the basic approach to being a druid, as far as again in within the traditions that I work with. As far as magic is concerned, though, I have kind of an odd background in all this because I came to druidry after almost 20 years of intensive study in the Golden Dawn.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a hardcore ceremonial magician, and so my personal style in magic tends to involve a lot of ceremonial work. And that was, you know, that kind of filtered over. The AODA, the Ancient Order of Druids in America, that I ended up head of more or less by accident, had a relatively ceremonial-heavy tradition. And then the book that I most recently wrote, The Celtic Golden Dawn, is about some people that took – it's based on the work of people who took that considerably further. It's a very ceremonial, very, you know, very formal ritual magical tradition that still uses druid traditions, druid teachings, Welsh lore, and things like that, which is kind of an odd mix for many people, but it works for me.
Well, now let me ask you, though, about that, because the Golden Dawn, as we know, uses a lot of Zohar and uses a lot of and Egyptian god forms, so it's a sort of you might say that, and of course then there's Enochian. And
there is indeed.
There is an Okean. Yeah. And so let me say, for example, if I were going to, and I'm not the one to do it, but I mean, if I were going to do a Druidic Golden Dawn, I would substitute Celtic god and goddess forms for Egyptian, and whereas the Golden Dawn does. And then I would probably use something like Graves' tree alphabet instead of his version of that Greek Kabbalah. I'd probably use that instead of the Zoharic Kabbalah, and then I would try to sort of structure it. The rest of it, initiatory using a Masonic framework like the Golden Dawn did. Now, is that pretty much what you did?
Well, to a certain extent, it was a little more complex than that, because I wasn't simply starting from first principles here. It so happened that when the Golden Dawn blew sky high in the beginning of the 20th century, there were a lot of refugees, basically, from the explosions. And at that time, the Druid scene in Britain was very active, but also relatively calm. There was not a lot of politics. Things were not really ugly as they were in the Golden Dawn and its successor groups. And so a lot of people ended up bailing into the Druid scene from the Golden Dawn, bringing all their techniques with them. And so you had these organizations emerging in the 19-teens, 1920s, and 1930s in Britain, like the Kabbalistic Order of Druids and the Ancient Order of Druid Hermetists and so on, who were doing these various kinds of fusion of Golden Dawn technique and Druid symbolism. Now, it so happens, you see, that after I became Grand Archdruid of AODA, various people, there had been some political troubles in the order long before I joined, and various people had bailed out. And then after I became Grand Archdruid, people started sending me stuff saying, you're in the hot seat now, you should have this. And I got some of the weirdest things in the mail. There was a period about 2 years now where I was almost afraid to go down to the P.O. box because you had no idea. One time, we ended up getting this cardboard box, a liquor box, stuffed with an old correspondence course from an Essene order. Why did we get it? I don't know to this day. But we got 150 lesson correspondence course from an Essene order that nobody else has ever heard of. But it was, you know, definitely mimeographed 1940s through 1960s era. But we got all kinds of stuff. But one of the things that I got at that time were fragmentary papers from two of these Druid Golden Dawn fusion groups. Not enough to work with, really, but enough to give the idea. And so I started working with the Golden Dawn techniques, Golden Dawn ritual methods and so on, and with ideas from the broader Druid scene, and with these scraps of lore that I got, and sort of fused it all together to make the system that's taught in the Celtic Golden Dawn.
Yeah, well, you know, the Golden Dawn had an aversion to conjuration devices as a result of their anti-hypnotic thing. And we all know the reasons for that, because of the mesmerists were having a field day terrifying people on stage during that time. And so the Golden Dawn had an aversion, even though Hockley was a great crystal ball magician and all that. But the Golden Dawn had an aversion to using conjuration devices.
Mm-hmm.
And
using
so,
crystal balls, mirrors, so on, yeah.
Yeah, crystal balls, mirrors, and all of the kind of items that we use, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Renaissance magicians were using. So
mm-hmm.
when you say Golden Dawn technique, I think I know what you mean, but
mm-hmm.
but I don't. I'm not sure the rest of us do. Now, what would you?
Okay.
Give us an example of Golden Dawn technique that you're using.
I can certainly run through that. The ritual techniques of the Golden Dawn involve a lot of course, tracing pentagrams and other lineal figures, ritual structures like the pentagram ritual. Purifications with water, consecrations with fire, the various sort of ritual structures you expect in a Golden Dawn setting, the use of the imagination rather than conjuration devices, as in scrying and the spirit vision, as in path working and so on, is a very important part of Golden Dawn technique. The structure of consecration rituals, where you start from the highest spiritual power and sort of cascade downward in the invocations, and a variety of other things like that. We don't use conjuration devices in the Celtic Golden Dawn. I didn't put those in for actually a very specific reason. I'm no good at them. Some people are talented with that. Some people aren't. I'm not. And I've never had much luck. I've worked with crystal balls. I've worked with magic mirrors. I've never had much success. But I'm really good at scrying and spirit vision. So I just and one of the rules that I always use in writing my books on magic is that if it's in one of my books, I've done it. I've worked through the whole system. And so I don't put things into my books that, you know, that I don't have at least some experience with. I put magic mirrors into my book Circles of Power, actually, because I had been doing some intensive work at that time and getting some results, not very good ones, though. And so I ended up kind of setting that aside and going back to what I'd learned in the Golden Dawn. So that's basically the excuse, if you will, for the lack of magic mirrors. Druids used things like that. You know, it's just or some of them did. It's just that the Celtic Golden Dawn doesn't happen to take that that path.
Well, that reflects, of course, the Victorian way of doing it, and that's when the mm-hmm. Druids, when the Druids were quite active. You know,
mm-hmm.
we've all seen the yearly ceremony at Stonehenge that the
mm-hmm.
British Druids put on, and
mm-hmm.
and they're very, you know, that's been going on ever since the days of the Golden Dawn. Are you affiliated with them in any way, or do you have reciprocity with them or something?
These days the British Druid scene is very fragmented. 20 different Druid orders that I know of in Britain right now, with various origins and so on. I'm on very good terms with the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. That's, I think, these days the largest of the Druid orders, headed by Philip Cargon. And actually, my original exposure to Druidry was by way of their course, and I'm still a member in good standing. And the other Druid groups I haven't had any particular close connections with, but I'm sure we'll all get along.
I mentioned the Order of 1734.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's what it was called over here in this country, and over
mm-hmm.
there it's referred to as the Clan of Tubal Cain, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still going over in England. It mushroomed all over the place here in the United States, and yeah, like so much else, yeah, right. But 1734 is a Robert Graves-based,
mm-hmm.
They call it witchcraft, but I'm not sure, so sure that it really qualifies as that. But
mm-hmm.
it is, and Roy Bowers was kind of a mad genius, put the thing together.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as their techniques are concerned, what they'll do, and I don't think I'm broaching any secrets at this point, seeing as how Anne Penn has published a book on it. What they do, their big ritual is at seasonals. They'll have one of their members will assume the god form or goddess form. mm-hmm. then they will all line up out there in the wilderness where they have their mm-hmm. ceremony, and they will all go up and have their audience with the god or the goddess. And of course, mm-hmm. what the member does is they meditate all day out there in the mm-hmm. woods. Mm-hmm. And until they actually assume the form of the goddess, and mm-hmm. do you folks do anything like that?
Not really. No, that kind of deity possession is something that's done in some traditions and not in others. I haven't really found it that useful, magically speaking. And it has certain potential drawbacks in that people who do it too much tend to get ego problems, unless they're very careful.
You really don't like it when you get up there in front of the god or the goddess and they start telling you about your personal failings, which they on their mundane side already mm-hmm. know about. We call that whenever we do a crystal ball thing and you have various mm-hmm. people channeling and they mm-hmm. start doing that, we call that politicking on the ball.
It's one of those things that happens.
I know this is one of the problems with the whole visionary thing. I mean, mm-hmm. when you start doing, you really, really have to have a good sense of humor and hold some of these people, really hold them in check.
mm-hmm.
But so you're avoiding some of those problems with the new druidic idea or
well,
concept.
That's the hope. That's the hope. Yeah. The thing is, every kind of spirituality is going to have its standard problems, and every kind of spirituality, because it's human beings who are practicing it, it's going to have the usual human failings. And I Isaac Bonowitz was, at his most inspired when he proclaimed the doctrine of archdruidic fallibility, which is that archdruids are totally capable of making mistakes.
Well, I didn't mention his name, but now you. I said, I think most of us. He said, I don't.
was he the one? Oh, he's funny.
Oh, yeah, he's the one. Yeah.
That sounds like Isaac.
I have such a warm spot in my heart for the whole Celtic tradition, of course, especially after Farfaria in 1734, mm-hmm. and my experience as a kid reading the Mabinogion and all.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Celtic pantheon is mm-hmm. really powerful and effective, and
mm-hmm.
and I've been thinking and along the line, and I'm going to run this by you and see what you think. When with the Hermetic Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Golden Dawn too. Even though they get as close to the Zohar, the Golden Dawn gets almost close enough to the Zohar, almost not to be Hermetic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they still are able. Yeah, it's there because they put Egyptian god forms in the
mm-hmm.
Azura, and
mm-hmm.
they knew and they have mm-hmm. Egyptian god forms for the various spheres,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just. And we, as you may know, we've developed an extended middle pillar
mm-hmm.
system where we put Phoenician god forms on in the
ah,
answer.
Okay, now, that works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what I was wondering is, how about if you got a Golden Dawn,
mm-hmm.
A Celtic Golden Dawn, why not put Celtic god forms in
We're already there. The tree of life, as given in the Celtic Golden Dawn, the 10 spheres have Welsh names drawn from old Druid tradition, and there are god forms from the Welsh Druid tradition assigned to each of the spheres. There are those are the names you vibrate while doing the middle pillar exercise, and so on. Oh yeah, we were not going to miss that one.
You've made my whole month here with that one because
I'm glad to hear.
I have been wanting so much for mm-hmm. this for this Western chakra system to take hold and for us mm-hmm. to go ahead and use it for the various traditions like this. Something mm-hmm. I've been trying to, you know, ask people to do and all mm-hmm. that. And I'm told, oh boy, that's wonderful. And
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
We can make the Tree of Life universal.
In fact, that's one of my upcoming projects. The book, The Celtic Golden Dawn, came out this fall, and its sales have been quite reasonable. And so I'm talking to Llewellyn. Llewellyn's the publisher. I've been talking to them about the possibility of a sequel, which will be called The Druid's Kabbalah. And it's going to be the Tree of Life and a range of things connected to it, approached from within the sort of druid magic that I'm teaching in this book. Now, there's going to be a lot of traditional types who are going to scream bloody blue murder, but then they're going to scream anyway, so I don't really worry about that.
Oh, they will. You know, anytime you do something as original and as creative as this, you can figure that the magical curmudgeons of which we have, they're in the woodwork, you know. I mean, the magical curmudgeons, and they come after you, but I'm so pleased to hear that you're doing that. That's wonderful, because this gives us a dimension that the Western tradition just didn't have for so long, be able to internalize these god forms, goddess forms. Mm-hmm. This is wonderful. We know how to get your book. You go on Amazon and you one click, mm-hmm. if you can one click, and one click Celtic Golden Dawn and anything else by you that strikes their fancy.
There's quite a few books with my name on them. So yeah,
you're doing it. Now the other thing though is how does one for those that are interested, how does one join your tradition?
Here's the complexity. At this point, I'm kind of by accident in charge of two different druid traditions. There's the AODA, the Ancient Order of Druids in America, which is the one that I became Grand Archdruid more or less by accident in 2003. And you can get to their website. It's www.aoda.org. Okay? That gives access to we've got a frequently asked questions page. We've got articles. We've got all the necessary stuff. It's a modestly successful, not hugely large, we've got fewer than 1,000 members, kind of druid order. And we're chugging along teaching because the AODA has been around for a while. It was founded in 1912, and it was chartered by a British group that was founded in 1874 that got its stuff from Wales, and we don't know how far back that goes. So it's very much a traditional kind of old-fashioned, some people call it stodgy, I call it interesting. So there's that. There's that.
Nostalgic.
On the one hand.
It's nostalgic. That's great. Repeat that website. That website again, so we get it.
Okay, that's www.
For those that have pencils and can write.
See, there we go.
Okay.
www.aoda.org.
That's easy enough.
I was a lucky man. Now, then there's what happened when I published The Celtic Golden Dawn, the book that we've just been talking about, because AODA has its own magical system, which I didn't come up with. I inherited that, and that's actually been written about in my books, The Druidry Handbook and The Druid Magic Handbook, which are from Weiser. The Celtic Golden Dawn, as I put this thing together, people started expressing some interest in that, and so there is actually a very quiet organization for people who are practicing that system. Now, I'm not going to hand out the website for that, because the thing to do there is get the book. If you're interested in doing this, you know, check it out from the library or read it at your favorite occult bookstore or what have you. Read the book and see if the teachings and the practices actually appeal to you. And then if you look in the back of the book, you'll find a website address.
Well, that sounds like a good plan. Quite often, you know, and we get looky-loos who think they're interested in something, and they're really not. But they're not people that are going to actually stick with it and get into it.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. Now, I'd like to while we're thinking about it and while we're on the subject. Now, I mentioned that Robert Graves had this he called it the analytic method. Where he would almost go into trance and write these things, be inspired, and come to conclusions that more conservative academics disagreed with and what have you, but they seemed
the gentle way
seemed right to it. It seemed to Robert Graves a good idea at the time, but he was convinced that there was a direct line of connection between Phoenicia, between the Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Celtic especially, and even the Nordic, because he even pointed out at one time that there were aspects in Beowulf that related to in fact, he even thought that Beowulf's Gotlanders were the same as the Greek Achaeans, as I recall. How brave would you come up with these things? But however, and sometimes it was pretty far fetched. But then on the other hand, his connection between the Eleusinian mysteries and what we've been referring to as the Druidic mysteries or tradition was a very, very large part of that book. I would think that the White Goddess was more Celtic. And it was just as much Celtic as it was Greek, and he seemed to interchange the two. Now, do you think that I kind of have a feeling that those Druids, the higher echelons of them, I think personally that they were literate, and I think that they probably read Greek. And probably could have, or if they didn't read Greek, they at least were aware of the connection. And would you agree with that, or do you think I'm?
I think Graves was onto something, although because he was using, he was using trance methods to get his information. When you do trance methods, you may get some fascinating stuff, but most people usually get it by the wrong end. And so now there's a really fascinating book by Nora Chadwick, who was a very important academic, a student of the Celtic of Celtic traditions and so on, whose books are, I think, still considered quite reasonable. Her book, The Druids, argued that let me step back here a moment. What we know of as Greek philosophy, whether it's the Pythagoreans, the Eleatics, all of the things, all the pre-Socratic, all the stuff before the time of Socrates.
The Orphic.
And so on. That was actually as much to be found in the Greek colonies in southern Italy and points further west as it was to be found in Greece itself. Pythagoras lived in a town in Italy. Okay, it was a Greek colony.
Yeah.
They worshipped the Greek gods. They spoke Greek in the streets. It wasn't in Greece. It was in Italy, and the most economically important of all these colonies was the town of Massilia, which we now call Marseille, in what's now southern France, and was then on the southern coast of Gaul. Okay, which was a Celtic country, which was full of crawling with druids. Okay.
Yeah.
Now Chadwick argued, and she had some very good arguments, although she's been ignored on this ever since. Chadwick argued that what the Druids were doing was their equivalent of Greek philosophy, that there was actually a band of continuity that was connecting what was going on with the Greeks and what was going on in these Greek colonies in southern Italy and in Marseille and so on, with what the Celts were doing, what the Druids were doing. And it was all kind of one continuum through which ideas were being tossed back and forth. Now, again, as I say, most of the academics have ignored this theory, but it explains a lot about the scraps of information we know about the ancient Druids. And I'm tempted to think there may be something to it.
Well, you got that. That's a book I want to get now. What was the name of it again?
It's titled The Druids. You ever notice almost all the books on the Druids are just called The Druids?
Yeah.
But the author is Nora Chadwick.
Nora Chadwick. Okay.
Nora Chadwick.
Now you know what this does though. This gets close to the horrible A word. And I love the A. Now don't get me wrong.
Wait, which A word did you have in mind?
The A word that gets you thrown out of an anthropology graduate program. And unfortunately, I didn't utter the A word, so I got a master's in anthropology. The A word is Atlantis. That's the A word.
That will get you
sunk
under
the
ocean. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, whatever. But you don't. You can talk about the maritime culture. You can talk about you can talk about anything, but don't ever say the A word.
Don't mention
but
Atlantis.
John Michel, I know you read John Michel's view of Atlantis.
Oh yeah. Oh good heavens, yeah.
Oh sure. And all those huge earthworks in southern Britain, and we know the chamber tombs. As you go down toward the coast in France and Spain, the chamber tombs get more of them and more of them. And of course Malta with the Hypogeum and that whole Minoan, that mystery of the Minoan culture. I think myself that Atlantis was very real, and off the southern coast of England, and into Spain in that area, and it was the prototype of the Minoans. That's what I think personally.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and that would have a connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that would connect all the way into the southern France area, which, as you know, in the early Middle Ages, southern France. Even in what we call the Dark Ages, southern France was a very civilized area. And your Languedoc, and that's where the Cathars and the Troubadours were, and of course that connection, I think that there may be some connection between the very ancient artifacts that we have in Britain, southern Britain, and all, even before the Druids. I mean, everyone says Stonehenge was built way before the Druids, supposedly.
Well, I'll get to that in a moment, because that's another point we're talking about. But, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about Stonehenge and that. Let's talk about that culture that supposedly preceded the Druids, and they even preceded the Celts, because I guess the Celts, how aboriginal the Picts were, even the Picts,
question.
I think, how aboriginal were the Picts, but there is a connection. Apparently, there's a connection here between the ancient pre-Druidic culture and the Druidic lore. Whether that connection is spiritual or implied or later projected or whatever, what do you think about that?
Well, now it was very popular for some years in the middle 20th century for archaeologists to insist at the top of their lungs that the Druids had nothing to do with Stonehenge. And the reason they were doing it, of course, is that the modern Druids were, of course, celebrating every midsummer sunrise at Stonehenge, and the archaeologists were kind of trying to elbow them out of the way. Nobody knows when Druidry got started in Britain. Nobody knows. It really is that simple. We don't know when the Celtic languages arrived in Britain. We don't know. We know that there were certain changes in tool types and material culture, styles of swords and things like that, that paralleled the expansion of certain ideas certain practices that are considered to be related to the historical Celts, and it really is that vague. And so nobody knows. Maybe the Celts came charging ashore the way that the Anglo-Saxons or the Normans did so many years later, and took over the thing and replaced the ancient, the older people who were there beforehand. And maybe it was just that certain ideas and traditions and linguistic habits drifted gradually across the channel. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
What we do know is that all of the Greek and Roman writers, or many of them, used to say that the ancient Druids were really hot into astronomy. They studied the movement of the stars, the planets, and they had all of this careful knowledge about this that they taught to their students. And, well, Stonehenge is pretty clearly about the movement of the sun and the moon and various other things in the sky. Furthermore, Julius Caesar says that Druidism was invented in Britain. It did not come from the Celtic homelands in Central Europe. It came from Britain. He says that.
Ooh.
And actually some of the Irish texts say that too, that, you know, Irish Druids who really wanted to get to the top of their form in the really ancient times would go over to Britain to study. And so the possibility that, of course, that nobody wants to talk about is that there was some survival of the traditions that were involved in the building of Stonehenge, because clearly there was somebody in those days who understood some basic mathematics, geometry,
sure,
astronomy,
yeah,
things like that. You know, you don't build a stone circle without having a grasp of astronomy and of geometry. And so there may have been...
That brings up, wait, John, hang on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hold that thought for just a second, because you're going to want to ask you something. This
I'm holding
what, the if they are, and you're right, and they had this astronomical and well, we could also say astrological knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
If they
very
had
likely.
It, then we would naturally assume that they were to some degree literate.
Actually, maybe yes. Maybe no. We know from that there are other societies out there, other
mm-hmm.
traditional societies, tribal societies, where they have mm-hmm. where people have handed down extraordinarily complex bodies of lore in memorized form, in oral tradition.
Yeah.
And usually they do it.
Usually
they do it in the form of mythology, because if you can tell something as a really rousing story, nobody's going to forget it. But so. Were they literate? We don't know. Did they perhaps use some kind of proto-writing, like the Inca, the way the Incas used to use the knotted cords, the quipu, which is kind of
mm-hmm.
not quite yeah. writing? We don't know. Nobody knows.
How old do you think Ogham? How old is Ogham?
Nobody has the least idea. the first traces that I know of are about the 2nd century AD, maybe, except aren't there some wooden ones from much further back? The Ogham stones that you find in Ireland, I think it's like the 2nd century AD is the oldest ones, but that may just have been the point at which it stopped being a secret of the Druids. Nobody knows. It is one of the world's two weirdest writing systems in some ways, because unlike any all the other alphabets are just kind of a straight line. Ogham and runes are divided up into groups. You've got your Eikme, your five groups of five in Ogham. The Elder Futhark, you have your three groups of eight, and there are some structural similarities there that suggest there's some perhaps much older influence that inspired both of them, but nobody knows.
Yeah, I think that we intuit,
mm-hmm.
and I believe you do also. We intuit a very very ancient origin for this,
mm-hmm.
and we intuit it. And I think you're right. I personally feel, but you're dug into this much much deeper than I have. But from my what I've read and from what I feel and from
mm-hmm.
what I sense, that Druidism has, however it may have evolved, is very 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 ancient.
There's something there that feels like it goes back a very, very long ways. That's about as well as I can quantify it. But there's something that feels very primal in all of this, despite the fact that we're working with traditions that, as far as we know, had to be reassembled from scraps in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for coming on board and giving us this fascinating look at a tradition that we all should whether we want to make it our main tradition or not. This is something that everyone involved in Western magic should certainly be.
Well, thank you.
I
really appreciate you being on. I mean, this has been a lot of fun.
Well, I can't tell you the truth. I haven't, I've ordered your book. I haven't gotten it yet, but boy, I'm sure gonna read it, and I know I'm gonna learn a lot. John, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next one. What would be a good druid, not Erangel Bra, of course, but what would a druid say to honor you as to farewell?
Why don't we go have a beer?
Oh yeah, that's what I like.
That'll be my druidical greeting.
Lauren just reminded me. What is your website again?
Okay, the website of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, the order.
Yeah, the website that you want us to.
Yeah, that'll be www.aoda.org.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll check it out. And thank you so much, Maestro. I really appreciate it. And we'll have you on again, hopefully.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, next week we will get into the Red Dwarf. And I think you're going to find it that fascinating. But we certainly, the opportunity to have John Michael Greer on was really wonderful. Anyway, so next week, I have a great holiday season, and next Thursday isn't Christmas, is it, Sandra? Next Thursday? Let's see. Today's the 19th. That's the 29th. No, we're okay. So next week, we'll see you, and we'll have Tales of the Red Dwarf who writes with his tail, and we'll see you then. And meanwhile, happy holidays and good magic.